The sound was deafening. Although no one was near enough to hear it, it ultimately echoed around the world. None of the passengers in the DC-4 ever knew what happened. They died instantly. It was February 15, 1947. The Avianca airline flight bound for Quito, Ecuador, crashed clumsily into the 14,000-foot-high towering peak of El Tablazo, not far from Bogota, then dropped, a flaming mass of metal, into a ravine far below. A young New Yorker, Glenn Chambers, was one of the victims. He had planned to begin a ministry with the Voice of the Andes, a lifelong dream that suddenly aborted into a nightmare. Earlier that day, before leaving the Miami airport, Chambers hurriedly dashed off a note to his mother on a piece of paper he found on the floor of the terminal. On the other side of that scrap of paper was what had once been a printed piece of advertisement with the single word, "Why," sprawled across the center. Of course, between the mailing of that note and its delivery, Chambers was killed. When it did arrive, his mother removed it from its envelope and tearfully read each handwritten word. But then, as she turned it over, there staring up at her was that haunting question in big, bold letters. Why? In a world that is still so violently marred by the consequences of the fall, this may be the single most difficult question we are faced with in this life. It's the question that forces itself upon each of us when a package of tragedy or disaster is dropped on our doorstep. Why? It's the question asked by a mother who gives birth to a baby with Down syndrome. It's the question asked by parents when they get that dreaded phone call late at night. Your son has been hit by a drunk driver. It's the question asked by a husband when the doctor informs him that his wife's cancer is inoperable. It's the question asked by a sister when told her brother has been the victim of a shooting rampage at the local high school. It's the question asked by a military wife when an official vehicle drives up to her curb. Two men dressed in full uniform get out and she hears them begin with these words. We regret to inform you. It's the question that's often aroused when mention is made of those recognizable words that need no adjectives. Those words which, when standing all alone, need no explanation. Words like stroke, miscarriage, bankruptcy, incest, melanoma. I'll tell you, friends, when the doors are closed and the curtains are drawn and the lights are dimmed, even the most vehement atheist looks up to heaven on such occasions and says, why? Several years ago, a Jewish rabbi by the name of Harold Kushner wrote a book to answer that question. It became a national bestseller overnight, "When Bad Things Happen to Good People." You remember the title? The son of this man had died at age 14 of a disease that strikes 1 in 7 million people. Progeria, it is called. It is the disease of rapid aging. Well, in his book, Rabbi Kushner phrased the question like this. If God exists, and if He is minimally fair, let alone loving and forgiving, how could He do this to me and my innocent child? It's the perplexity of a broken-hearted father, isn't it? He then proceeded to set forth three possible answers to his question. Possibility number one, God is just and therefore only gives to people what they truly deserve. Possibility two, God is cruel and therefore commonly gives to people what they don't deserve. Possibility three, God is kind, though not all-powerful, and therefore not able to prevent people from experiences of suffering and pain. In the first possibility, the rabbi offers us a God who is a just but merciless tyrant. In the second possibility, he offers us a God who is a powerful but sadistic monster. In the third possibility, he offers us a God who is an affectionate but impotent grandfather. Are any of those possibilities comforting to you? They fill you with hope? If you are a person who reads and regards the Word of God, you quickly recognize these possibilities as woefully inadequate explanations of the living God. To be sure, beloved, our God is inflexibly and uncompromisingly just. But He is not only just. To be sure, our God can and does inflict pain. But He is never capriciously cruel. To be sure, our God is kind. But His kindness is not in the slightest way limited by a lack of potency. The inspired psalmist says it like this: "The Lord does whatever pleases Him in the heavens and on the earth, in the seas and all their depths." Everything that takes place in this universe does so as an expression of obedience to the eternal decree of the living God, beloved. Whether we are talking about the length of a human life, the amount of rain that falls, the orbit of the planets, the appointment of our political leaders, the size of our congregation, or the IQs of our children. When we assert that God is sovereign, we mean, among other things, that everything that takes place does so according to His predetermination, including a wayward child, a difficult marriage, a stressful job, a malignant tumor, an abusive parent. Now, this does not discount the reality of human choice, human decision, human wickedness, human evil, for which every person will one day be accountable. It is to say, however, beloved, that what God decrees in eternity, man will of his own accord demand in time. You remember Pontius Pilate and that angry mob? "Which of the two do you want me to release to you? Jesus or the murderer Barabbas?" "Release Barabbas!" "If that's the case, then let me wash my hands of this whole affair. I am innocent of this man's blood." Do you remember the response of the crowd? "Then let his blood be on us and our children. Crucify him!" Now let me ask you, what had God decreed in eternity past with regard to His Son? That He would be crucified. What did that mob demand that Friday afternoon, that Friday morning in Jerusalem? That Jesus Christ should be crucified. Now let me ask you, were they aware of the fact that they were fulfilling the eternal decree of God? No. Was God forcing them to do something against their native desires? No. Of their own volition, they freely chose a course of action for which they will be fully and altogether responsible. A course of action, however, that had been foreordained by God Himself. God is sovereign, beloved. In eternity past, He determined everything, including evil and all of its attending consequences. Now, very much related to God's sovereignty is what we refer to as God's providence. Sometimes we actually use these terms interchangeably, but most properly speaking, the sovereignty of God speaks of His predetermined purpose. The providence of God speaks of his working out of that predetermined purpose in time. It is the guiding and the steering of all of the details of your life, bringing them to their predetermined ends. The steering and the guiding of every aspect of the created order to their predetermined ends. My guess is that most of you here have seen the movie Anne of Green Gables. You know the story of that little orphaned girl who by and by finds herself in the care of a spinster woman and her single brother, Marilla and Matthew. And as the years go by, their love for one another grows and it deepens and they become profoundly affectionate with one another, the three of them. And the time comes for Anne to go away to college, and so they go to the train station, and there she is in the train. The train is pulling out of the station, and tears are streaming down her cheeks and down the cheeks of Marilla and Matthew. And Matthew says to his sister, "We didn't even want her. We sure were lucky." At which point Marilla says, "It wasn't luck that brought her to us, Matthew. It was providence." The Heidelberg Catechism says, "What do you mean by the providence of God?" The answer: the almighty and everywhere present power of God, whereby, as it were, by his hand, he upholds and governs heaven and earth and all creatures, so that herbs and grass, rain and drought, fruitful and barren years, meat and drink, health and sickness, riches and poverty, yes, and all things come not by chance, but by his fatherly hand. The Belgic Confession says, "The same God, after he had created all things, did not forsake them or give them up to fortune or chance, but he rules and governs them according to his holy will, so that nothing happens in this world without his appointment." My dear friends, if you are going to possess a truly Christian view of God, a view of God that has been ripened by the totality of biblical revelation, then it is essential for you to recognize that everything which takes place in all of the created order does so as a consequence of God's divine appointment. The joys and the sorrows, the victories and the trials, the prosperities and the tragedies. Now, beloved, this little story of Ruth is a story about God's providence, the outworking of his sovereign plan in the lives of his covenant people. But even more to the point this morning, it is a story that details the dark shadows of providence. In fact, at its very outset, we're taken back by its amazing candor, its almost brutal honesty. If you've seen the movie Saving Private Ryan, you know what I mean when I say that if you can sit through the first 15 minutes, you can make it through the rest. That's what this story is like. In a matter of a few short verses, the dark shadows of a violent providence relentlessly assault this woman named Naomi. When we finally hear her speak, we hear the words not of a super saint, but of a real human being who is raw from the circumstances of life. There is no false piety. There are no empty-headed spiritual cliches. There is, however, a very clear recognition of God's providence. In the end, it is a story that will show us that God's dark shadows of providence are ultimately an expression of his wisdom and his goodness, ultimately his purpose to save his people from their sins. In the sufferings of this woman, you will see the signature of the living God. My hope, beloved, is that in turn you will be more able to quickly identify God's handwriting in your own sufferings. Now, as the story opens, the narrator sets the scene. And you'll notice that he does so very quickly. In five short verses, a woman's life is decimated. He provides very little detail. Notice that there is not word of explanation for any of the circumstances Naomi endures. Not one word of explanation, by the way, in the whole book. There is no attempt to justify God, no attempt to vindicate God in the bleak conditions He gives to this woman. You read these first five verses and there is no compassion, there is no feeling, only the cold recitation of the facts stripped of everything except the most essential detail. You see, friends, a good storyteller knows not only what to include in his story, but what to intentionally leave out for the effect that he wants to produce in his listeners. If this writer was a movie director, you can imagine him at the end of verse 5 pulling back the camera from Naomi's face, and there you would see her, standing alone on the hard ground of a stark and barren prairie, looking at the raised mounds of three graves with the bite of bitter wind blowing in her face, unable to cry. And you find yourself filled with two sensations. One, compassion for her, sympathy for her. But secondly, questions for God. Why have you done this? Where have you been? And at that moment, the hook has been set, and the storyteller has you in his grip. He's established in your heart and mind a tension that screams for resolution. Now the dark shadows of providence cast themselves across the path of this woman, Naomi, in six ways. The first three are very broad and general. The second three are much more specific and personal. Here's the first. In the days when the judges ruled, more literally, in the days when the judges judged. Now, friends, I told you 2 weeks ago, this is a story. But it's not a make-believe story. It's not once upon a time in a galaxy far, far away. This is a story specific as to time. It occurs in that period of Israel's history, sandwiched between the death of Joshua and the coronation of Israel's first monarch, King David. And if you know anything about the Old Testament, you immediately recognize this to be a bleak and dark and desperate time in Israel's history. It was a period of moral anarchy, everybody doing what was right in their own eyes. It was a period of religious apostasy. The worship of the true God was commingled with the most perverse forms of idolatry. And it was a day of defied, rejected authority. There was no king in Israel. Sounds very much like our own day. Well, to chastise His covenant people, God would raise up a nation to bring violent oppression. In turn, God's people would repent. God would then appoint a judge, a military kind of deliverer, who would rescue His people out of bondage. Upon their deliverance, they would gladly follow Yahweh for a while. Before long, they would break the covenant again, only to find themselves back under foreign oppression and domination. And this cycle, you see, repeats itself seven times in the book of Judges. The author's burden is to say, this was the established pattern of the people of God. It is bleak. It is an ugly, dark time, difficult to remain faithful to Yahweh. And it is during this time that a man and woman meet. Elimelech, Naomi, they fall in love, they get married, they have two sons. But it is not an environment conducive to healthy, happy, covenant-honoring families. It was the day when the judges judged. But my dear friends, when the listeners who were hearing this story read or told several years later, hear the storyteller begin like this. In the days when the judges judged, Not only would their minds immediately establish the proper historical context, their curiosity would have been piqued. Peer to the judges, eh? Will this be yet another story of unfaithfulness on the part of our people? Or will this be a story of God's mighty intervention on our behalf? Secondly, we're told there was a famine in the land. A famine on top of everything else. I mean, you've got moral degeneracy, you've got religious apostasy, you have defied, rejected authority. Now you have this economic catastrophe. The land isn't producing, and don't forget, dear friends, we're talking here about an agrarian culture. There is no money to be made. There is no food to be purchased. And in such cases, you know how it goes, huh? You've read history. The powerful exploit the poor. The poor bite and devour one another. People are wasting away. Children are starving to death. And you need to appreciate the extent of this famine, beloved. This is not a famine in the local town of Bethlehem. We're told that it's a famine in the land. And that's good Old Testament language that's a reference to the entire land of Israel, the land, the promised land. It's a comprehensive famine from Dan to Beersheba. And what's more, this is not a passing slowdown that soon reverses itself. It must have lasted for many, many, many years. We know this for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's the thing that finally compels Elimelech to move his family to Moab. And secondly, in verse 4, we're told that this family stayed in Moab for 10 years until they heard that the famine had come to an end. What am I trying to say? This isn't a passing dark providence, beloved. These are long, hard, dark days and years of a frowning providence. Thirdly, as I've already mentioned, a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while, went to sojourn in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah. Now, why is this a dark providence? Well, on a couple of different levels. First of all, and most basically, have you ever moved? Is that a joyful providence in your life? It costs money. It creates incredible stress. It is physically taxing. It is emotionally draining. It means pulling up roots, leaving friends, severing family members. It necessitates looking for a new place to live, getting to know new people. In this case, it meant a different kind of people who speak an altogether different language. It meant having to find a way to assimilate enough into the culture so that you might earn a living to provide for your family. It meant being surrounded by a radically different religion. But even more importantly than all of this, beloved, what you need to attempt to appreciate is that it meant leaving the one land, the one piece of geography that God Himself had singularly promised to bless, the land that under the old covenant God had uniquely given to Israel. The covenant people are there. The place of worship was there. The tabernacle was there. The Ark of the Covenant was there. God's Shekinah was there. The law of God was there. The priests were there. The sacrifices were there. To leave that place? Oh, from the perspective of an old covenant believer, it couldn't get any worse than this. There was only the hope that there might be a better shot for survival in Moab. If I was a betting man, beloved, I would wager that this man, whose name means, "My God is King," Elimelech, is asking the question with biting irony, where is God in all of this? It's the days of the judges. It's the days of famine. It's the days of divorcing yourself from the covenant community. But just when you think the providences couldn't get any darker, they do. Darker because they now become more personal. Verse 3. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. Just as the famine had shattered the solidarity between a man and the land, now death destroys the solidarity between a husband and a wife. It's simple, it's straightforward, it's without feeling. He died. Naomi must have asked, why? I don't get it. What kind of a God is it that cannot keep a single Israelite alive in a foreign land? Well, by and by, we can assume Naomi begins to cope with her loss, as widows do. My mother is a widow. I can appreciate this. She still has her two sons after all, and together this trio continues to make a go of it in Moab. Then, some hope dawns. A sliver of joy is brought into Naomi's life. Some sweet medicine for her bitter grief. We're told in the next verse that her sons get married. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. They find companions. They find partners. Maybe now, after all that we've endured, things are finally taking a turn for us in our favor. But beloved, there is something much more here than this, you see. These marriages open up the prospect of children. And this is a cause for great delight, not only because of the joy associated with children, but because children can carry on the family line. And so for the first time in a long time, Naomi dares to be happy once again. Anticipation prevails. Joy is restored. Yahweh has not forsaken us. But then, just when it seemed as though those dark shadows were lifting, Naomi's joy is betrayed by another dark providence. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. God has devastated this woman. Here she is, left alone. She has gone from wife to widow, from mother to no mother, a woman alone in a man's world, all of her identity has now been stripped away. In fact, this is the way the text reads in the original, beloved. The Hebrew in verse 5 says, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman, not even Naomi, the woman, was left without her two sons and her husband. The dark shadows of divine providence cast themselves across her path in 6 ways. She lives in the bleak days of the judges. She suffers in famine conditions for years. She is forced to move away from the land of promise. Her husband dies. Her sons die. And though not mentioned specifically, but very clearly implied, she is bereft of heirs to carry on the family line. She, as an Israelite woman, is now faced with the worst possible life circumstance. She is the remaining member of a covenant family on the brink of extinction. I heard someone say this very week, you know, God would certainly have a lot more friends if He treated the friends He had a little better. Who's responsible for this? Is this chance? Luck? Fate? karma.
Is she right? She is dead right.
This has come to me from the hand of Yahweh, our covenant God, that name that harkens back to God's name revealed to Moses, I am. It is that name that speaks most profoundly of God's sovereign self-sufficiency. I am has done this to me. The God who is Shaddai, the Almighty, all-powerful God, has brought this to bear in my life. My dear friends, as Christians, we are not dualists. God and Satan are not two independent sovereign powers using human beings as chess pieces in their cosmic war against one another. Satan is a creature, which means that he is much more like you and me than he's like God. He bears all of the limitations associated with creaturehood. He is not all-powerful. He is not everywhere present. He does not know all things. Everything he does, for which he will be held eternally responsible, is altogether determined by the sovereign will of God. Satan is God's minister to effect God's purposes in this world. When an earthquake hits and a Planned Parenthood clinic crashes to the ground, Christians say, "Look at what God did." When an earthquake hits and a church building is destroyed, the same Christians say, "Look at what Satan did." No. We say like Job, "The Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Why is one baby born healthy and another with Down syndrome? Why is one baby born with the intelligence of a rocket scientist and another with a learning disability? Why is one child given the skills of a concert violinist and another a deformed hand? Who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord? So why did God do this? Some might say, well, it was because it was a sin for this family to leave the promised land. That's why Elimelech died. It was wrong for them to leave the promised land. And the boys, they died because they married Moabite women. Elimelech and his sons, they got what they deserved. God just simply meted out a just punishment. That's a superficial answer, to be sure, beloved. The unfortunate thing is it just doesn't stand the test of Revelation. You read the book of Genesis and what do you discover? Abraham left the promised land in the time of famine, and as we'll see in 2 weeks, was profoundly blessed for it. And so did Jacob. And so did Isaac. And there was no explicit law forbidding the sons of Israel from marrying Moabite women at this particular time, especially when they were living outside of the boundaries of the promised land. Don't forget, dear friends, Esther, living outside of the promised land, married a non-Jew, and as a consequence, proved to be the deliverer of her people. Every time the storyteller has an opportunity to assign some guilt on the part of these people so as to vindicate God's appointment of dark providences, he refrains from doing so. Don't read that into this. And my friends, you know, we in the same way have to be very careful to refrain from doing the same thing, lest we become so much like Job's counselor. You're sick. You're poor, you're unemployed, you're afflicted in some way. The only answer is there must be a direct connection between this affliction and a particular sin in your life. I find it absolutely amazing that Paul's experience was the exact opposite. His thorn in the flesh was not the consequence of some sin, but given to him for the expressed purpose of keeping him from sin. For Naomi,
This, you see, was the most devastating thing of all. There is no explanation from God. She undoubtedly searched her heart like we all do. What sin have I failed to confess? Where did I go wrong? How did I offend God? For what great iniquity is He punishing me? But looked as she did, there was nothing there, which made these experiences all the more crushing. You see, beloved, it's easier for us to live with dark providences when we know that God is chastising us for some obvious disobedience. What makes dark providences nearly unbearable to endure is when there seems to be no direct reason for them. And those big, bold letters stare right back up at us. Why? Well, let's turn the corner a bit, shall we? When the dark shadows of God's providence are cast upon your life, friends, there are two very important things that you must never forget. Firstly, our God is unfailingly good. There have been times in my own life that if I were not convinced that such was the case, I would have done anything in my power to end my life. This is the thing at the end of the day that helps us to get out of bed, you see. Our God is unfailingly good. Now, we'll see it in this story, but friends, let me just tell you this. This story is a masterpiece of literary structure. And by inspired design, you see, the dark providences that are here in this opening paragraph are answered by direct joyful providences in the concluding paragraph. In the opening paragraph, what do we discover? It's the time of the judges when Israel had no king. In the closing paragraph, God's provision has come in Israel's greatest king, David. In the opening paragraph, the first name we read is the name of a man who dies, a man named Elimelech. My God is king. And in a paragraph that is notorious for its lack of detail, two times in the first two verses we're told that he was an Ephrathite from Bethlehem in Judah. In the final paragraph, the concluding paragraph, the last name we read is a man who reigns, whose name is David. He is God's king, one of the other two men in all of the Old Testament who is defined as an Ephrathite from Bethlehem in Judea. And who is that remaining person? But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel. It's a dark providence, to be sure. But God will prove himself faithful. He will prove himself good. In the opening paragraph here, a very unusual word is used in verse 5 to speak of adult males. In the NIV, it's translated sons. Look at verse 5. Both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was left without her two sons. But in Hebrew, it's not the same word that's used back up in verse 1 and 2. The more common word for sons, banim, here, in a very rare usage, the storyteller chooses a Hebrew word, yaladim, which his hearers would have immediately picked up on because it was so unusual in this kind of context. It's a word that's used to speak of very young children. Perhaps it might better be translated like this. Both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was left without her two babies. To be sure, it's an unusual way to refer to two grown men who are married. Now, it's a term of endearment. It's a term of affection. It helps us appreciate something of the significance of Naomi's loss. But more than that, beloved, the storyteller has an agenda here. Because he takes this particular word that he injects at this very unusual place, and he reminds us of it again in the last paragraph of this story when we're told that Ruth and Boaz have a son. And they took the layet, the baby, and they laid it in Naomi's lap. The Hebrew listeners would have picked up the connection immediately. God is compensating her loss in a way that is far greater than she could have ever imagined. It is a dark providence, but God will prove himself good. In the opening paragraph, beloved, we're told that these couples were married for 10 years and there are no children. There's infertility, 10 years, barrenness, 10 years. Does it ring a bell with any of you by chance? Remember Sarah, the wife of Abraham? You remember that scene when she brings to Abraham her handmaiden to provide Abraham with an heir? How long had they been married? Genesis 16 says they'd been married 10 years with no child when Sarah brought to Abraham her handmaiden Hagar. Do you realize, beloved, that rabbinic law indicated that a man had a legal right to divorce his wife after 10 years of marriage if no children had been born to him? This statement that they'd been without children for 10 years, it wasn't merely a chronological note. It was giving us an indication of how dark this providence really was. What will happen to the marriage? What will happen to the relationship? Something is wrong. Something is amiss. This is a concern to us. But in the closing paragraph, what do we find? We find a list of names. A list of names. Have you counted them? There are 10 there. Is that an accident? Not hardly. The storyteller is showing us how God has compensated for 10 years of infertility with 10 generations of heirs, including King David, and as we know, a trajectory of heirs that ultimately includes Jesus Christ. It's a dark providence. But God will prove himself good. Beloved, you come to me with some dark providence in your life, and I will pray with you, and I will weep with you, and I will love you, and I will care for you, but I will be woefully inadequate to answer the why question. I don't know why. I can't begin to know why. I don't know what God is doing. The reason I get out of bed in the morning is because at the end of the day I know that he's good. And at that point, what that means is I have to cup my hand over my mouth and bow my knee in submission to his lordship. Some time ago, our dear sister Angela Kirk endured an unbelievably dark providence. And many of you remember this. I went to my office one day shortly thereafter and I sat at my desk trying to make sense of this just as you all did. And I wrote some words that I thought might one day become the lyrics to a song. Well, they weren't very good, and so I put them aside. For the first time in several months, I looked at them yesterday afternoon. And the refrain to this song says exactly what I'm trying to say right now. All of our hopes and all of our dreams must ever be submissive to his sweet sovereignty At times he will hurt us to form his work of art. Though we can't trace his hand, we can always trust his heart. He is good. And we must remind ourselves of that when the shadows of dark providence cast themselves across our path. And secondly, when these dark shadows of providence come, beloved, remember to interpret them by the means of the cross of Jesus Christ. What do you mean?
As he hung suspended between heaven and earth on a Roman cross, he endured the darkest providence that would ever be endured by a human being. Abandoned by his friends, beaten by his enemies, tormented by his people, forsaken by God. And he asked the why question, didn't he? My God, why? Why have you forsaken me?
What's the answer?
Fate. Chance. An accident. The permissive will of God. The victory of Satan.
Read the very first Christian sermon ever preached, Acts chapter 2. Jesus Christ was crucified by the predetermination of God Himself. It was the darkest providence in the history of creation. Why would God do that? The answer came 3 days later, when God raised Jesus Christ from the dead. And what do we learn from this? That the darkest providence had purpose. The darkest providence had intention. The darkest providence was filled with design. It was the means by which the sovereign God would save sinners like you and me, all who will turn to Him in faith. And now, beloved, we learn from this paradigm, you see, this becomes the hermeneutic for our sufferings. We must learn that every dark providence which casts its shadow in our lives comes from God, is filled with purpose, and will always result in His glory and our good. You'll come to be convinced of it as we study this story. Would you bow your heads with me, please? Our Father, we love You, and You are infinitely greater than we could ever begin to conceive. Forgive us for our paltry views of who You are, for our nearly idolatrous views of You. You are great and vast and sovereign over all things, and we bow our knee before You this morning. We thank You for the encouragement of knowing that every dark providence that comes into our life is a gift from You. Give us the grace to endure it. And Father, in Your mercy, allow us to see Your divine purpose and intention in it. We love You in Jesus' name. Amen. Would you stand with the beloved? Let's sing.